This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, a children's book, The Excellent Adventures of Max and Madison, Bedtime Stories for Youngsters. And the author is Grandma Betty. And Grandma Betty joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Grandma Betty.
Good morning.
Well, great to have you with us all the way from Victoria, Australia. And sounds like you're right in the studio with me.
Yes, it is wonderful, modern technology, isn't it?
It is. It has its great, great advantages, and it also, and we're going to talk about some of that, it also has its distractions, especially for kids, and they need to let that imagination run. Let me read what you've written about your book. You say this: reading bedtime stories to children seems to be making a comeback these days, and many parents tell me that they find it hard to locate suitable books for their children. The stories are based on old-fashioned values in this book, are nonviolent, encourage good manners and self-confidence, and are basically full of good, wholesome fun. Grandma Betty, you obviously saw a need, and how did this all start?
Oh, it started with my little step-grandson, Max, who, when I met him, he was just about to turn 4 years of age, and he had a lot of trouble settling down to sleep at night. He used to wake up sometimes with nightmares, and he was just a nervous child, and his mother and my son, who is his stepfather, used to make him make up stories every night. They'd sit by the side of the bed, tell him a little story, but they would make him the hero of the story, and that would allow him to feel like a little hero, and they'd calm him down quietly and ease him off into hopefully a good night's sleep. And they were telling me that, you know, they were running out of ideas every night thinking up a different story. So I thought, well, I could probably write something to keep him occupied, and that's how it all began. But they live several hundred miles away from us. I live in Melbourne, in Victoria, and they live in Canberra, which is the nation's capital, but it is quite a distance away. So I would post the stories up to Max every 2 or 3 weeks as I wrote them.
Now, these stories, there's 35 of them in this book. Sounds like the beginning of maybe more, but tell us about just the overall makeup of the story. Now, they're a quick read.
Yes, they are. There were several things I had to keep in mind. I didn't want to make them too long because he was only 4 years old at the time. And plus, if you keep a child, if they were too stimulating, the child wouldn't settle down to sleep. He used to be terrified by the news items. They used to always turn the television and the radio off when the news was due. So I had to be very careful to make them peaceful and quiet and make them interesting at the same time. So that they took a fair amount of thought. But this is how they evolved, and that's why I wrote them at random. But very few of them are connected. They're just individual stories which stand alone. So the child can read the story and go off to sleep. He doesn't have to worry about episode 2 or Timmy's still stuck in the cave type of thing. There's no suspense. So I took all of that into account, and I tried to make them simple but interesting. And hopefully I've achieved that.
Well, you have a firm belief that children are exposed to too much reality today.
Yes, I do. And I feel that adults are exposed to too much reality as well. But then that's me. I have very old-fashioned ideas. But with the media today is inclined to emphasize earthquakes. I know there are terrible things happening in the world, but the media is inclined to keep it going day after day after day. And whether children are watching the television or listening to the radio or not, they are in the vicinity and they pick up these things and they hear adults talking. And I feel it creates a feeling of nervousness, and children feel unsure of themselves. And so a little bit of fantasy, especially at 4 or 5 years of age, a little bit of fantasy is good for them.
And make-believe is necessary even for a healthy childhood.
I think it is. And I know that watching my own children grow up, we grew up in a suburb of Brisbane, which is in tropical Queensland, very north in Australia. And our children had a wonderful childhood with the other neighbourhood children, and they ran out in the street and they played. But we lived in a street which was a dead-end street. I'm not sure of the term that you use, but it finished in front of our house. And the mothers could all watch the children playing out in the street, but because there was no through traffic, the children thought they were out playing on their own, but we were watching them through the windows of the house. So they spent many hours out there playing together, riding their bicycles, doing all sorts of things together, and they had a good, happy childhood. They weren't inside all the time.
Now, Max and Madison live on a farm.
No, they live in a little cottage on the edge of town.
Oh, okay.
And there's a farm just outside town, but opposite them is a national park. So we're able to introduce the animals in the national park, and they can hop on their bicycle and ride, pedal down the road a short distance to interact with the farm people.
Ah, where they have dairy cows and chickens and geese and ducks and even bees.
Right.
So they get exposed to a lot. So you've kind of focused in on these animals, I guess, both living on the farm as well as in the forest.
That's right. It gives the children something different to talk about, and they interact with the animals. Of course, they're quite young, and they talk to the animals, but that's part of the fantasy world. But all the time, each story has a little kernel of knowledge in it. So once the story's finished, the children have usually learned something by the end of the story. In fact, one or two of the adults who have read the stories have laughed afterwards, and they've said to me, "I didn't know that fact." You know, such as there's a story about a little Australian animal called an echidna who loses her little baby. She can't remember where it is, and the baby is called a puggle. And the average Australian person doesn't even know that. So it's just one little thing that's in the story. Children learn as they go along.
Well, let's talk about some of your favorite stories. Why don't you kind of give us, without reading, obviously, we don't have time to read a story, but give us some about the characters and why you decided to use a certain animal or a certain storyline.
As an example, little Madison, when I started writing the stories, she was only 18 months old, so she didn't actually feature in the earlier ones. But I received a text message from my daughter-in-law one day, and this is exactly what she said to me. She said, "I heard the front door slam, and I looked out of the window, and there was Madison, 3 years old, with her bare feet, pushing her little toy shopping trolley, and she called over her shoulder, 'I'm off to the shops, Mum.' So by the time my daughter-in-law got out of the door, Madison was halfway down the block, and she had to pick her up and bring her home. So I turned that into a story called Madison Go Shopping. See, and Madison, so even now, she's 5 years old now, and she still does very funny things. And little Max, he's a little magician. He's 8 years old now, but when he was 5 and 6 years of age, he had his own little magician's cape and his hat, and he had a little box of tricks. And at his own birthday party, he was the magician, and he was very, very good. So I wrote some of the magic tricks into the story. And occasionally somebody would do something. As I said, my daughter-in-law would send me texts. So I would think about it for a few days while I'm going about my daily business, and the story would sort of write itself in my head. Then I would sit down in front of the computer and write the story. And our family and friends can see themselves. You know, sometimes somebody did something or said something, and I've turned it into a story.
Well, here's some of the titles of the stories. Clarence the Cuckoo, A Fish Tale. Katerina and Her Magic Trick. Madison Buys Some Shoes. Max Gets a Job. Percy the Pesky Possum. Well, there's a Day at the Zoo. The Circus Comes to Town. So you're also, you know, obviously taking advantage of real life, like the zoo and the circus, where all kinds of animals and experiences are perhaps new to the children or something just that they love to do.
Yes, Adobe Zoo is also, I have two stories about that. There's another one called Maximus Leone, because if the children are not in the story, they, sometimes the stories are only containing animals, or one of the characters in the story would be named Max. That's why you'll see there's Maximilian, there's Maximus, all different ones. And this particular one, Maximus Leone, I wrote that to try to explain to children that having a second language can sometimes be of assistance, because my husband is Italian-born, and I called the character, there's a lion in the story, he's the main star, he's Maximus Leone. Well, Leone means lion in Italian, but it was also my maiden name before I was married, so I wove all that in, and it was about a lion who'd been brought over to Australia to be part of the breeding program, but because he came from a zoo in Rome, he couldn't understand English. And as the story goes along, Grandma Betty and Grandpa Dominic have gone to the zoo, and they've taken Granddad's mother, who is Nonna, and she was born in Italy, and she picks up the fact that the lion is sad, and they speak to each other in Italian. And I say at the end of the story, it's always helpful if you have a second language. It's something different. I get these ideas. That's why I say they're all mostly unconnected. Some of the stories have characters that have been introduced, such as Percy, the pesky possum. He appears twice. But by and large, they're all totally separate stories which are unconnected, and they appear out of the blue, and they're just a nice little story for someone to sit down. And as Max does now, he's 8 years of age, he sits down and reads the stories on his own.
Well, other titles, The Secret Garden, Be Careful, B with B-E-E, and then, of course, The Shape Shifter, The Steam Train, The Fairy Tree, The Clown with the Little Pink Nose. You can see such a variety. 35 great bedtime stories, and Max and Madison are featured. What are some of the lessons learned, the morals that you're teaching?
Well, the story I mentioned earlier about Katie the echidna who loses her little puggle, the story there is Max tells the echidna she's panicking, she can't think straight, and he says to her, you have to sit down, you have to stay calm, because you can't think when you're all upset and confused. And he calms her down, and then once she settles, she remembers where she left her little puggle, and she goes off and she's happy. So we're trying to teach children not to panic, just to stay calm. And there's another one where there's a little penguin who's tired of eating fish, and she wants to eat something different. Her name is Penelope, the penguin. So she goes off to live with some cousins in the country, and they come to the farm near Max and Madison's house. They come to Joe McDonald's farm, and she lives with animals which... There's another story called Birds of a Feather, where the ducks and the geese from the farm go to the beach to meet the penguins, because they know that they're all birds and they're related, and they go to see their cousins, and they appreciate the differences between themselves. They know they have commonalities. They are birds, but they are totally different. So Penelope goes to stay on the farm because she's tired of eating fish, but she soon comes to realize that she's a penguin and she doesn't belong on a farm, and she's meant to eat fish. So she goes back home, but by this time she's happy with the fact that, yes, I am a penguin and I eat fish. I'm not a duck. I'm not a goose. I'm not a swan. And this is who I am, and I'm happy with who I am. That's the lesson that she learns.
And you're also helping children learn how to solve problems.
Yes, helping the children. They don't dissolve into tears and run looking for an adult. If there's a small problem, you stay calm. And you think about it. Max is always thinking of something, and he will sometimes say, let me think about this problem. And then they think about it, and then they stay calm, and then they come. I mean, they're only small stories, but I'd like to think a 4 or 5-year-old child would, instead of saying, oh, look, something's gone wrong, and then they just sit down and dissolve into tears and what am I going to do type of thing. So hopefully children will be quiet and calm, but have fun at the same time and be inventive. Because there are very few adults in the stories. They're in the background, but every now and again, I stress the good manners, that the children want to do something, they always check with their mother or father first to see if they can do something. And when they're on their bicycles, they always check the traffic. I always try to put forward road safety and whatnot without beating people over the head. I don't want the children to feel like they're sitting in a classroom being taught, you must do this, you must have manners, rah, rah, rah. This is more just a natural way. Children are courteous, but they can still have lots of fun.
We're listening to Grandma Betty, all the way from Australia, and she has this wonderful children's book, The Excellent Adventures of Max and Madison, Bedtime Stories for Youngsters. Grandma Betty, tell us how to get your book.
Well, you can Google the book, but you buy it from Balboa Press, or on if you go on Google, it's on available at Amazon, and it can also be downloaded as an electronic book if you wish.
Well,
hopefully it will be in a good bookstore near you soon.
Definitely. We appreciate you being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on Toginet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on Toginet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to Toginet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on Toginet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Reiki Fur Babies, and the authors, Ming Chi Brown and Candy Boroditsky. They join us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Candy.
Hi, how are you?
Great to have you with us, and hello, Ming.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Well, this is very unique. You say animals are speaking to us, and we should listen a whole lot more because we could literally hear their voices, and we'll talk more about that aspect. But you're into healing and how not only healing these fur babies, but how they can help us heal. Let me read what you have written. This book tells the story of two women whose love for their pets took them on a journey that began with giving healing to their own precious fur babies. They soon discovered much more than they ever imagined. As they connect with all types of animals, their hope is to be able to deliver the animal messages about how they help us heal. This is an inspiring true story of healing, transformation, and love. Well, there's a lot to talk about right there. That's tremendous. Tell us about yourself first, and let's begin with you, Candy.
Well, I've always worked in medicine. I worked in physical therapy. I ran programs at a hospital. So my background was in the medical field. And I've always had a love of boxers. So that was my pet, and always have had boxers, and always had in communication, ability to communicate with my pets. I thought it was just me and my pets. So my background is medicine and with my boxer babies.
Ming.
And that's it.
Go ahead, Ming.
Okay. I have a doctorate degree in pharmacy from University of Southern California. I grew up in Seattle. I've always loved animals my entire life. I grew up with cats and a rabbit. Currently now I have a yellow lab and a corgi, and the yellow lab is the one that inspired me to learn Reiki, because she was diagnosed with canine hip dysplasia and wasn't actually able to even walk at the age of 4. My husband was carrying her up the stairs, and as my brother introduced this another way of healing, I thought I wanted to try it. And as I tried it on my own dog, I found that she was actually able to be healed over time. So after that is the journey that we both began to help other animals.
Explain what is Reiki.
Reiki is healing energy. It's sometimes people call it Japanese energy healing. It's a type of healing that we act as a conduit, where the energy flows through us and to the animal. So the energy comes through our hands, and as we place our hands on the animal, or actually what we do is we do distance remote healing, which means that we can have a client anywhere in the world, and it's like a radio wave or how the television works. The energy just flows through us to that particular animal. And so the animal can stay wherever they are. They don't have to go anywhere. They can stay in their home with their pets, with their mother, their father, and all the other pets in the room can also feel the healing energy. And what we did is we just took testimonial after testimonial of how each pet received the help. And we combined all of these testimonials, which is why we wrote the book.
Candy, tell us about your experience with your dog, Rye.
Well, that's when he started my journey with Reiki. I was more reluctant. Ming kind of dragged me into the training. Her brother is a physician, and he does Eastern and Western medicine, and he was very moved by how this healing energy worked. And Rye became ill with cancer, and this was before I had any training in Reiki. And I was just like shocked that he had cancer. How could this little lump, he wasn't even 5 years old, happen? And the whole journey of, you know, let's try chemo, let's do this, let's do that, it was just horrible. You know, the swelling, the radiation treatment on pets is as horrific as it is on humans. I tried a couple sessions, and Rye just literally said stop. I mean, actually used the word stop, and came into my lap, and I could, you know, he actually asked me to stop the treatment. He just wanted to live his life out without any more needles, without any more radiation, without any more chemo, without any more medicine. And that's when I said, I'll honor your wishes. And I learned to listen. He had the most phenomenal life. He lived another 6 months. And with the chemo, it might have given him another couple months. Come on. And he played. He had the most joyous life. And it came time for him to cross over. He actually came to me and told me it was time, had a plan. He went to where he always goes, the kennel, where he knew everyone. All of his little furry friends were there. All of the caregivers that he knew, you know, all the pet people were there. Everyone got to say goodbye. And it was a loving, tearful goodbye. But it was like on his terms. If we could all live and pass this way. It was such an honor to have had this dog in my life. And the lesson he taught me is respect and to please listen. And after Rye is when I learned my Reiki. And I thought, I could hear. And I just couldn't hear Rye. I could hear other animals. And that was my surprise.
Ming, tell us when you knew you had these, how you were able to use archangelic energies. You've talked a little about that. Can you give us a little bit more understanding of how that works?
Yeah, we have the privilege of having archangels, and angels help us in our healing. It was just kind of a evolution of our spiritual journey as well. I mean, when you work with energy healing, everybody has a different path. Some use, flower essences, or some other healers use this or that. We actually were able to invoke the angels. The angels have a very strong connection with the both of us, and we just brought in the angels, the archangels, to join us in healing. And we have seen profound miracles with the archangels. Many times we will send angels or archangels ahead of time to the pet or to the person that we're working with, and we'll hear a story from them before even the actual session. I mean, it's very, very powerful. And a couple of years ago, I started talking about angels, and I thought maybe somebody, I was a little nervous actually about it. But I realized it seems like this time in our planet, a lot of people are talking about angels. And as I kept talking about it, nobody would bat an eye. In fact, yesterday we had a session for a 200-pound Newfoundland. And the owner said, Saul wants an angel. When you do your session on his paw, because he had hurt his paw, could you please send him an angel because his sister Emma has one and Saul doesn't. So this was actually requested by our client just yesterday. So that's funny you would ask that question.
Why don't you share some more on that, Candy?
Oh, about the archangels?
Yes,
well,
yes.
We've had some, and these are testimonials. We just, like, for the conduit for the session. And our clients will tell us, like, all of a sudden, they'll actually feel the angels surrounding them. They'll see the colors of the angels. They'll actually get the messages. It's amazing to me that this is happening and during the sessions. So for me, it's really moving to have it all being transpired during it. And Ming will say, I need help with this, and we'll ask the angels to please help. You know, Archangel Michael helps with healings. And I always say, you know, there's so many angels, I don't want any unemployed angels. Come on, angels, let's everyone get a job and send the angels out to work. And there's always an angel for everybody. You know, if you need help, they're there. And I'm not a religious person. I mean, I'm spiritual. So I was really moved when they entered into our healing practice. I was very moved by all of this myself. And these are the testimonials from the clients. This is what happened to them during their healings, or their pets, or what they saw, or what they felt, or the colors that entered their rooms. I think one of my favorites is always when we'd give, like, Reiki to one horse in a barn of 50, and every horse in the barn would be quiet for that one session. Not anyone moves. They all just absorb it, and everyone's still, and what they all feel. And this is when owners are standing by and observing this themselves.
Now, you connect with all kinds of animals. You just mentioned horses.
Horses, fish, hamsters. Everything.
Yeah. Guinea pigs, rats.
I have a squirrel.
Cats, dogs.
Everything.
Any kind of pet.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be a pet. Obviously, the squirrels in my yard are not my pets.
Right. Right. Now, tell us more. Both of you can comment on this. Because you write that your hope is to be able to deliver the animal messages about how they help us heal.
Right, exactly. We, after animal, they all have the same theme, and it's all about gratitude. They have gratitude towards their families that have rescued them. They have gratitude about their life. And even the ones that have been abused or some terrible things have been done, they never focus on that negative part. But what they do is they focus on who has them now or who's showing them love. We had this one lady that gifted a session to this dog that was horribly, horribly burned. It was actually going to die. It had been so abused. And when we went in to give the healing, all the dog could say was that he was grateful for all of the love he was receiving now. He could feel it. He could feel all the people coming around him and giving him love. And we've also found that dogs with cancer, whereas, you know, when we get cancer, we're so attached to the disease and we're anxious and angry and afraid. But the pets, they're not. They dissociate from that disease, and all they do is they focus on, well, we trust our mom. Our mom will make the best decision. We are, they're just grateful for all the care and the love that they're receiving. And it's a great lesson for all of us because we found that each animal, even a fish, will tell you the same thing. And they're so intuitive, and they see families as a whole unit, as the universe. We're all connected. So it's amazing. As we continue to give healing to all of the animals, we keep learning to share with everyone else what they actually want us to learn.
These are touching stories, serious stories, but there are also some funny ones.
Lots of them are funny. Coco in our book is very, very funny. She's actually one of our funniest clients, and Coco is our bi-monthly client for over a couple of years. So since we know Coco so well, I think each time we give a session to Coco, it's not just because she has a problem. It's just that Mom wants us to connect and see what's going on and see life, you know, from her eyes. And we always laugh because we think Coco must have been a person in another life because she's the way she talks. No other dog talks to us like this. And I can read a little excerpt, actually, from Coco. Coco said, Mom filled our small space with two large people, and the young, immature Coco would not have been happy with this invasion. This is when Coco's mom had her cousin stay with them. But Coco was delighted to share with how our time went. Coco is the master of ceremony at Coco's home. Coco is engaging, entertaining, thoughtful, and funny. Then everyone departed and Mom went for a short drive, and because of the stress of our new guest, Mom got lost. Coco says, really lost. Mom was driving for hours. She was trying to find Santa Barbara. Is that Santa Claus's sister? Well, because of Coco's common sense and devotion, Coco stayed very quiet and still. Coco thought, well, if we get to Santa Claus's house, there would almost certainly be treats for Coco. But no, that never happened. No Santa, no anyone, and Coco just got home and collapsed. Now, we thought this was so funny because anybody that lives in California knows that there is a Santa Claus lane on the way to Santa Barbara. We had no idea that they were actually going to Santa Barbara. So Coco saw and heard Santa Claus lane, so figured Santa Barbara must have been related to Santa Claus. See, isn't that hysterical? We thought that was very funny.
Candy, we have enough time for a closing thought about your book.
Well, I think the book is a window to your animals, you know, and we're just like you, Ming and I. We're two women with husbands, with jobs, with children, lives just like you. And everyone can hear their animals. I think if you just stop, look at them, and listen, they have something to say. And they're loving, they're nurturing, and every bit of love you give them, they give it back to you. Every pet owner already knows that.
We've been listening to Candy Boroditsky and Ming Chi Brown, the authors of their book, Reiki for Babies. Candy, tell us how to get your book.
You can get our book from Balboa Press. You can get our book from Amazon. And you can, Ming, how else?
You can get a signed copy from our website. We'll sign it. And that's ReikiFurBabies.com. You can order it directly from us as well.
Thank you so much for being with us on, Thank you so much for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you.
This interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Want to be challenged in a powerful way to leap beyond what you think is possible? Then join us Mondays for the Leah Jansen Show, every Monday at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com with Leah Jansen. Listen live as life coach Leah uses her coaching skills to give you the tools you need to take action and create momentum. You are encouraged to call in and share your greatest fears, challenges, and obstacles, and then listen as Leah obliterates those barriers to success. For more on Leah and the show, check out her website, LeahJansen.com. That's Leah, LeahJansen.com. Spend 1 hour with Leah, and you'll be captivated by her energy, enthusiasm, and magnetism. You'll quickly become addicted to her positive attitude and make-it-happen mentality. Ready for a life-changing, mood-altering show? Then get ready for Leah Jansen and listen live to The Leah Jansen Show every Monday morning at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Battle for America, Socialism and Christianity. And the author is William G. Lord. And Bill joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Crossbooks. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
This is going to be an energetic discussion about America. Unfortunately, some views of America that are going to not make people very happy who listen to this, but at the same time, it's reality, and we need to deal with it, especially as Christians. And this is a Christian book. And you say this about your book: The Battle for America cuts through the distraction and the side issues and reveals the true identity of the political enemies of God and the Republic of the United States. This book is unlike other Christian books because it enters the camp of the enemy to expose the enemy. Christians read Christian books and are usually unaware of the workings of the lawless. That quite an introduction right there.
Yes, it is.
We're going to talk about the lawless, the enemy, the political enemies of God, and of course this true identity that you're going to expose who they really are. Now, Bill, what was the motivation? How did you get on this track to publish this book?
That's pretty easy. That's been where I've been for almost 12 years now. God called me into ministry around 2000 from a very successful career in aviation maintenance. He took me on a trip to Israel in 2000. My boss called me and asked me if I could be, he called me on a Wednesday and asked me if I could be in Israel on Monday. And I asked him why, and he said we'd just bought a 747-200, and Israeli Aircraft Industries had got the contract to modify that from a passenger to a freighter, and the guy they was going to send over there couldn't make it, so I was to go over there and stand in for him for a while, and just like overnight, I found myself in the world where Jesus walked, and he had been crucified, and he used that as a working in my life to set me on this track, and it woke me up, and as I began to look around and talk to other Christians, I found that Christians were ill-equipped to handle what was going on in the world. In fact, they were unaware that there were any problems in the world. Most of them live in a world that is a Christian world, and it's almost like they live behind the wall. And the secular community interacts with Christians like myself, and they're nice enough, and they are not telling us most of the time that they don't believe in Christ, and they don't believe that God is the Creator. And we assume, as Christians, that things are fine, and we don't see it. It's a hidden force that is working against the kingdom here on earth. And after that visit to Israel, God took me on a visit to Europe, where I seen churches that were turned into dance halls and bars, and I began to think, what caused this? Why are we not aware of what's going on in the world? And from there, God took me on a study that paralleled my master's study in Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, and I did both studies at the same time. And what I found was that there is a parallel world out there that is looking to destroy the Christian world, and we were not aware of it. I know that I was totally into my work and did not see the movement of the lawless that was paralleled. I worked with them. It was as if Paul's words in 2 Thessalonians about the lawless working of being among us even now came to life. And what was unseen, now I saw. And from that point, I asked God to just let me know what to do. I'd never written a book. I had all this knowledge and didn't know what to do with that. I thought, well, I'll be a pastor, and I did that for 3 years in New Mexico. But the anxiety just really continued, and he directed me in this venture was to write down what I had discovered, the trip that he had took me on through the theological studies with a parallel study on the lawless. And that's how we got here. And this book was developed over 7 or 8 years of studying. And for me, it has been an eye-opening experience. I stand in the world now aware of the dangers to the kingdom of God.
Well, here's your alarming statement. The Constitutional Republic of the United States of America is on a path to be dissolved and replaced by a social democracy.
That is true. As I did my study, what I did was I compared where we're going with what happened to Europe, what happened to Canada, and what happened to Mexico and countries around the world. And what I've seen was shocking. First is the education system. We now have an education system that teaches secular values. I always understood that that was a secular motive in our public education system, but I did not understand the term secular. As I began to study in the term, I found that secularism is, and it has its roots in the socialist ideal. It has its roots in removing God from the campus of ideas. And that is what our educational system does. And our future, any civilization's future, is in their children. We are teaching our children in our public school system to be other than Christian. So, I mean, if we teach them that, then what future do we have but that? And overwhelmingly, that is the case. We look at the California schools where now they have brought in the sexual education for homosexuals, normalizing that event in children's lives, much less adults' lives. And we see that sweeping across the nation as we view our political landscape. And that is not something that just evolves in isolation. That is taught in our schools. Our children, who are our future, are now beginning to accept the alternative lifestyle.
Well, and we have a president who every year in June issues an executive order for June Pride Month for homosexuals and lesbians and others. So it's right from the top.
Oh, it is. And this is from someone who says that he's a Christian.
Right.
And that is so confusing to the Christian
that's
mind.
Right. That is confusing, especially to children. But what's something you point out is that we really could be in charge. There's enough of us. Christians could be in charge.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As I did a study along with this study, it took me to especially after 9/11, it took me to a study of the Muslim culture. And what the Islamic faith is doing, and what I found was is the Islamic faith has taken a look at the Western culture and their Planned Parenthood movement, and they have made a decision that they could actually overcome the West through the womb. They can actually do it, and it makes sense if we live in a democracy and we have. The Islamic people bear more children than we do. Eventually, they will control the vote.
Well, that's happening in Europe.
It is. It is. And as I studied Islam, that was one of the things that came out, is that in Amsterdam right now, if you were going to Google and you Googled 2030, we take over, you will find the youth in that city and other cities in Europe are wearing T-shirts that say that, 2030, we take over. That is a reference to the amount of Islamic people that are in Europe. So they are really close in assimilating European culture into the Islamic faith through procreative actions. In the United States, Christians have done just the opposite. We have bought into the Planned Parenthood, and we face a hostile government. Our own government is hostile towards us because we do not have the resources, the power, the people standing at the voting booth to change this. Because more and more of our children are secular, and we are producing less and less physically children of Christ.
Right. Well, we have about 4 minutes, Bill. I wanted to talk about your book. It's divided up into three parts. Your first part zeroes in on the founding fathers of socialism, the history of socialism. Give us a few comments about that, and then we'll have a few comments about the second part and the last part.
The history of socialism is a very well-wrote-of event, and what I tried to do was give a genetic history that formed the thought process, and I went back to the first communists were Babeuf and the Conspiracy of Equals in 1796. And what I found there was the foundation, like our Constitution is the foundation of how we live in America. And what I found, their Constitution and their Bill of Rights and their tax structure is really that they had proposed in France are really the foundation for the communist, socialist, lawless, progressive movement that is moving throughout the globe. I found a proposed hate crimes bill that reads much like ours. I found a progressive tax system that punishes people who do not join in to their sacrosanct democratization of the world, everybody is equal. And no revelation of God is allowed into their system. I found all of that in the first communist. These first communists were actually guillotined in France for their views. But people like Robert Owen in England, and Karl Marx, of course, and Engels, and Edward Bernstein later on with the revisionist policies, they all have these first communist fathers' policies and processes built in to their own processes and policies. And in fact, we find in the writing of Karl Marx and Engels, this group are written of very admirably by the two holy fathers of communism.
Your second part is a commentary on the impact of socialist ideologies on Christians. So we have just a couple minutes left for that and the last part, a comment.
Well, basically the impact section is, we've heard a lot about the nanny state, and in the book I kind of put organization to that thought process about how the socialism would like to displace Christianity as the ruling authority and policy making at the legislative level. And what they do is they insert themselves into the legislature and move the country through legislative and judicial endeavors to a communist society. And by doing that, they move the country from what might be a theocracy to one that is an anti-theocracy or an atheocracy, one that is built on a secular society and ejects God and all religions. And basically that's what Paul was talking about, the workings of the lawless in 2 Thessalonians, in that government is set up to eject divinity from rule.
We have one more minute, Bill. I wanted you to have a comment that your last part reveals what Christians may do to receive the blessings of God in their lifetime.
I think it's pretty obvious. In Exodus 19:5, God told the Israelites that the condition for being called by his people, called his people, is obedience. If we look at Genesis, the first couple in the Bible, the condition for blessings in the Garden of Eden was that they obey the one rule, don't eat from this tree. And we see that humans through time have disobeyed God. And when they disobey, they do not receive the blessings. God removes the hedge of protection from around them, as he did the first couple. And throughout time, the Israelites, by disobeying God, had that hedge of protection removed. And through the disobedience, we find ourselves unprotected by God, and we can no longer call ourselves God's people. So if we as Christians desire the blessings of God, we must rediscover the text and live by it and obey him and do his bidding and serve him instead of ourselves.
The title of the book, The Battle for America, Socialism and Christianity, and the author is William G. Lord. Bill, tell us how to get your book.
You can get an autographed copy on williamglord.com. I set up a site specifically for that. If you want an autographed copy, you can also get it from crossbooks.com and Amazon, Barnes & Nobles. any of the other traditional book outlets, you can get it. It's also available in ebook form.
Thank you, Bill, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you for having me.
This interview has been brought to you by Cross Books.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.